Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Well, hello, world, and welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live. This is the Rose Live. Rose Colombo coming to you from the West Coast, but it's kind of chilly today, over in the good old USA. Wherever you are, I hope it's a little warmer than it is over here. Before we enter into the world of authors and experts, I would like to share some tips on the subject that is on everyone's mind, the coronavirus scare. The best way to beat fear is to face it and be proactive, combat it, and kill it. We are at war with an unseen virus, and it appears to be targeting people 50 and over, but more aggressively, the elders. It could be your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents who are 80 years or older. And so that's very serious because many of them have underlying health conditions. They're on different types of drugs, and they may have some other chronic illness. Organizations have weighed in with advice on the products that can help protect us and our homes against the coronavirus, as well as businesses. It is common sense that we need to do these precautionary instructions, which should be common sense whenever a flu hits, a virus hits, pneumonia hits, a cold hits. We all self-isolate. We are sent home from work if we show up at work. I mean, it is common sense that these flus, colds, influenzas, viruses can spread. Regular cleaning with normal cleaning supplies does a great job of removing all kinds of germs, not just coronavirus, from surfaces, said Catherine Roberts, associate health editor at Consumer Reports. Focus on high-touch areas, that's faucet handles, doorknobs, stair rails, countertops, the things that you have your hands on all the time. Robert suggests making a checklist of all the places you want to clean so you don't forget any of them. But commercial disinfecting products contain pretty serious chemicals, she warned. They're actually EPA-registered pesticides, so as much as you can, try to use them when kids are not around because they can trigger asthma. The demand for disinfecting wipes may be outstripping the supply right now, but there are many other products you can use. In fact, you may already have some in your home. The Environmental Protection Agency has a list of those that meet its criteria for use against the novel coronavirus. The CDC website also has recommendations for households with suspected or confirmed coronavirus cases. Here's what you need to know about what will and won't work against the coronavirus, according to the experts. Believe it or not, soap and water. It's not fancy, but soap and water work. The soap removes the viral particles that have attached themselves to surfaces, whether it's your hands, face, or countertops, and suspends them in the water so they can be washed away. Do you know that there are some countries who do not use soap? And we have open borders, and some of those people are in our country, and hopefully they get the message that they must use soap and continuously wash down their surfaces and their hands. Richard Sacklabon, soap are actually detergents that not only remove the germs from surfaces, but also kill them. The virus has an outside coating, and the stuff inside, DNA or RNA, is what actually causes the disease. It's kind of like casing on a bomb or torpedo, Sacklabon explained. For a virus, that coating is a protein, and the soap or detergent break up that coating, so the virus spills its gut and falls apart. Well, that's a good explanation. Bleach solution. Bleach is very effective killing the coronavirus as well as virtually every other germ on the face of the planet, said Dr. Paul Pottinger, a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Washington Medical Center. The problem is it's stinky, it's hard to use, and it can damage what you're trying to clean. To protect your skin, you should wear gloves when using bleach. Don't mix the bleach with anything but water. Here's the CDC formula for making a diluted bleach solution. Use 5 tablespoons, 1/3 cup of bleach in 1 gallon of water, or 4 teaspoons of bleach in 1 quarter of water. Keep in mind that bleach is a harsh cleaner. So if you go this route, do a little test before you clean an entire surface with your homemade anything else. Bleach can also damage some paint, and over time, it can corrode metal. So be cautious if you use it, Sacklabon told NBC News. Better. Hydrogen peroxide is also suggested. It's not as strong as bleach, likely to cause damage, but it can discolor fabrics. Sacklabon said, don't dilute it. Use it straight. Hydrogen peroxide decomposes into water and oxygen. Alcohol. Rubbing alcohol products that are at least 70% alcohol will kill the coronavirus with less potential for damage than bleach. When using rubbing alcohol, don't dilute it. Consumer reports say rubbing alcohol is safe for all surfaces but can be discoloring on some plastics. So hydrogen peroxide and alcohol and Clorox are very difficult to get today. So you may want to take these precautions that are listed on this website. And you can Google the website, in fact. So despite what you may have seen on social media, vodka is vodka to clean your surfaces, Robert said. The concentration of alcohol in vodka is not high enough to kill the viruses. So don't get your bottle of vodka if you want to have a drink and try to use it for disinfectant. It isn't going to work. Tito's Handmade Vodka tweeted a warning that its vodka is only 40% alcohol and therefore does not meet the current recommendation on the CDC that hand sanitizer needs to contain at least 60% alcohol. So a quick swipe isn't good enough to decontaminate the surface. You just can't swipe it. You've got to scrub it. Really scrub it until the entire surface is wet, then let it dry on its own, Pottinger said. So these are just some of the tips that are online that you can find, you can Google, and be sure to sanitize your hands and after you touch any doorknobs or you're out in public and you're touching those carts. You can take wipes, or you can take a paper towel with you and at least wrap it around the handle of the carts so you aren't touching them directly, and then sanitize your hand as much as possible. And so that is my tips for the day by the experts and the doctors and the CDC and so forth, who are attempting to eliminate the coronavirus, hopefully by April. So let's, if everyone takes responsibility for their own actions, be proactive. And on that note, we will be entering into the world of authors and experts. And today we have a dynamic expert and an author. And his name is Ron Singerton. And he's going to provide us with a little of his background in just a moment. He is a honored, he has been honored with the Chanticleer International Book Award, first place for late historical fiction. His latest book was published by PenmorePress.com. It is entitled A Cherry Blossom in Winter. It is a page-turner, and it is about the Japanese-Russian War before the Revolution. In fact, there's a beautiful quote by John Dilyansky, author of the King Scarlet and Blue Water Scarlet title. His quote is, "This is a sweeping work about the clash between Western and Eastern cultures, pretended morality, and grand passions struggling against heavily ritualized matrimony." The author's observations about Russian society and his grasp of its good and bad points would likely have gained an approving nod from Tolstoy. This is a first-rate storytelling. That says a lot. So we're going to take a little break, and when we get back from our break, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts with our very special guest. And we will be back in just a minute, so don't touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you. But some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to ColumboChronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColumboChronicles.com.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up, everyone, because now we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts. And today's dynamic author and award-winning author is Ron Singerton. He was born and raised in Los Angeles. He graduated from Cal State University, Long Beach in 1965. He is a graduate work in international studies, and he served in the United States Army from 1966 to 1970. Some of his time was spent in Japan, which allowed him to gain a sense of that culture, which he later used in his writings. He taught history and art for nearly 30 years in Compton, Los Angeles, and San Bernardino, both middle school and high school. For a number of years, he was a Civil War cavalry reenactor, but his favorite sport was fencing saber. And following his teaching career, and he admires his wife, Darla. She owned a art gallery in Idlewild, California for 8 years, and she's still involved in her art, jewelry, painting, and stone. That's fabulous. And he's been writing for the last 15 years, and he admires his publisher, Penmore Press in Tucson, and who's also going to be publishing his sequel, which he'll tell us about. And so that is a little bit about Ron Singerton's fabulous background and his latest book, hot off the press, A Cherry Blossom in Winter, The Japanese-Russian War Before the Revolution. So let's get started and let's say hello to our very special guest, Ron Singerton. Hi, Ron. How are you today?
I'm really great. And I want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to discuss my novel, A Cherry Blossom in Winter, and the times and events that take place in the novel. And by the way, the sequel, A Blossom in the Ashes, will be out next month. And it will be on Amazon, like my other books, Villa of Deceit and The Silk and the Sword. Both of those are about an ancient Rome, which is quite a departure for me from teaching modern history. But, yeah, it's I love writing. It's intoxicating, and it's really a joy to do.
Well, you know, I've been reading your book. I'm not finished, but I've been reading it. It's a page-turner. I love it, and it's worth the read. It's worth the purchase. So, and I thank you for sending me a copy because I am enjoying reading your book. And
I'm
so,
wonderful.
Oh yes. And so I can't wait to finish it. So, you know, back in those days, the 20th century, it says that it dawns on your back cover, Japan is a rising power at odds with determinedly expanding Russia. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, aristocrats advance their political interests and have affairs as factory workers starve. What was your motivation to write about this? And tell us a little bit about your beginning of your book as well.
Well, the beginning actually begins with a haiku, a Japanese haiku, and it says, anguish and longing, bud on the cherry blossom, on winter's bare branch. And I was fascinated by what was taking place very early in the 20th century. You know, although the Russo-Japanese War is but a footnote in the history books, it was the first major war of the 20th century, and it was really the first nail in the coffin of the Romanov dynasty, a 600-year-old dynasty. And the Japanese victory in that war set the stage for their invasion of Korea in 1910, in China in the 1930s, and it all led to the war in the Pacific in 1941. So it was a tumultuous and world-changing event, which I really wanted to explore because not that much had been written about it. And as I say, it was almost a forgotten event, but it was absolutely crucial to the first half of the 20th century, and even up to today, you know, when we look at what happened in North Korea, between North Korea and South Korea in 1945 and continuing on to this day. So it was really an interesting area to write about. And I like to write about areas that have not necessarily been other authors might not have spent as much time on. So to tell you a little bit, I can tell you a little bit about the story if you wish, and just to give people an idea of giving them an overview of the story, if you'd like me to do
so. I would like you to do that, but I did have a question for you because as I was reading it, you talk about the revolution and of the factory workers, and did that fact that the workers at that time were starving, even though they were working long hours, they had no unions, no protection for employees, which many still don't today, did that have any effect on you and your book versus what's happening in third world nations today that is still a problem for those people living in third world nations?
Well, yes. At the time, this was the beginning era of industrialization in Russia, which came a bit later than the rest of Europe. And, of course, there were no safety nets at all for workers in Russia. But most of the people were still peasant farmers. There were not that many areas in Russia outside Moscow and St. Petersburg where there was really industrialization, although it was the beginning. And there were enormous hardships for those people, which eventually would build up to the first revolution of 1905, which was put down with enormous force by the Tsar's government. So, there was that inequality building at that time, as well as today in various countries.
Okay,
does that answer your question?
So tell us a little bit about your key characters and what is the theme of your book and how it begins.
Okay, in a nutshell. In the beginning of the story, our hero, Alexei, a teenage aristocrat from St. Petersburg, Russia, travels to Japan with Count Brusilov, who he believes is his father. And in Tokyo, Alexei becomes infatuated with Kimi-san, who's a beautiful Japanese girl. But her brother, a naval officer in the Japanese Imperial Navy, tells Alexei that he must never see her again. And at the same time, Count Brusilov seduces a geisha who dies after a botched abortion. And the Count and Alexei must flee back to St. Petersburg. And through letters and communications, Alexei and Kimi-san develop their relationship over a long period of time. Alexei is crestfallen, of course, when he can no longer see Kimi-san, but he's enrolled in the Naval Academy in St. Petersburg, where he makes a terrible enemy of a man named Boris, an upperclassman and a violent adversary. And eventually, Kimi-san and Alexei meet in London in 1901 after the death of Victoria, and they have a torrid love affair lasting one night. And Alexei is accused by the Russian government of giving away military secrets, and he's sent to Siberia to what would have later been called the Gulag. However, war clouds start building between Russia and Japan, and he's reinstated in the Russian Navy and put aboard a Russian cruiser. But to his dismay, he finds that Boris, who is now a spy, is on the same ship. There were, within the Russian Navy, a lot of revolutionaries, and that's actually where the Russian Revolution began. The Japanese attacked Port Arthur in 1904, and they destroyed the Russian fleet there. And so a second Russian fleet of obsolete vessels is sent from the Gulf of Finland after being blessed by the emperor. They sail 18,000 miles to engage the Japanese, and the fleet faces mutiny and breakdowns and total ineptness, but continues on, even though Port Arthur has fallen. It all comes to a head at the Great Battle of Tsushima in 1905. And Alexei must not only contend with Boris, who's still out to get him, but as Japanese shells fall around the Russian fleet and tear the Russian fleet apart, he fears that, of course, he will never see his love, Kimi-san, again. And, of course, to find out what happens, your audience, I hope, will go and read the book. So that, in a nutshell, is the basic story of Alexei and Kimi-san. And in the sequel, by the way, A Blossom in the Ashes, the same family of Alexei continues on into the Second World War, which A Blossom in the Ashes takes place mostly in the Pacific during World War II, but also in the Soviet Union. So it was really exciting to investigate that and find out some very, very interesting details that took place during World War II that, again, are not written about very much. So that's basically the story of the book, and I hope that it will fascinate people.
Well, I'm sure they will be totally fascinated, because it not only involves the story about how the Russians and the Japanese were at war with each other, but it also involves human interest and the fact that that one of your characters is a wife abuser. And appears to be an alcoholic, and they're having all these, and not the father of the son who didn't know that, and all of these different human interest factors are played into your book too that happen even today, unfortunately.
Right, and we can get into what Russian society was like for the elite at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. But I did want to mention that a lot of the people mentioned in the book can be seen on my website, Ron Singerton. That's S like in Sam, I-N-G-E-R-T-O-N, ronsingerton.com. A lot of the individuals mentioned in the book can be seen on that website. And also, this might really interest your audience, if they type in to the web and go to the coronation of Nicholas II, they can see the actual film footage from 1896 of the coronation of Tsar Nicholas II and all the elite and powerful people that are portrayed in this three-minute film. It's really quite fascinating. Yeah, that to me was very interesting to actually see the people that long ago in that particular film.
Yeah, and in the 20th century, how did Japan view the world based on your research and your book?
Well, when Japan looked at the world around them, and this was a motivating factor in the war between Russia and Japan, what they saw was that and of course, you know, Japan was opened up by Admiral Perry to the world in the 1850s, and after the American fleet, so-called Black Fleet, visited Japan, and the Emperor Mutsuhito, a young boy, was put on the throne of Japan, and the Japanese began to modernize, and they did away with the samurai and so forth, and Japan ended the feudal period. And the people's allegiance in Japan was directed from the shoguns and the warlords to the emperor. And prior to his ascendancy, most Japanese had no idea who the emperor was. He was a cult figure, sacred and divine, and it was compulsory to worship him once he took the throne. And the common people were not even allowed to look at him. However, to answer your question, Japan looked around the world, and what they saw was neocolonialism and neo-imperialism. They looked about, and they saw the European powers divide up Africa. Britain, France, Belgium, Germany controlled nearly all of it. The Europeans controlled large areas of Asia, including much of China, Southeast Asia. The Dutch were in Indonesia. And, of course, the United States defeated Spain in 1898 and controlled the Philippines, Guam, Midway, and basically Cuba, too. And but the Japanese saw their greatest threat from Russia. And what the Russians had done in 1897 is they built the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which allowed the Russians to bring 150,000 troops into what was then called Manchukuo, now Manchuria, via the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And that, to the Japanese, seemed to be an enormous threat. And they feared that in this era of colonialism and neo-imperialism, that, in fact, they may be a target of the Russians. I don't think the Russians had any intention of invading Japan. But there was, within the minds of the Japanese at the time, the fear that with imperialism and neocolonialism, they might be a target. So that's where their thinking was at the time.
So can you tell us about the epic journey of the Russian fleet and the devastating battle of, how do you say that, Tsushima that destroyed it?
Tsushima, yeah. Yeah, what happened was that after the Russian Navy was actually destroyed, it was called the First Pacific Fleet at Port Arthur. Nicholas II decided that he would have to go to war. Of course, the Japanese had already declared war with this sneak attack, which was considered a great and brilliant thing at the time, very ironic. But the emperor blessed the fleet, and his wife made icons for all the ships, and 42 Russian vessels, most of them very obsolete, set sail on this epic journey to defeat the Japanese at Port Arthur. The entire fleet, and in fact Russia, nearly went to war with Great Britain, and Britain had 28 battleships, and the Russians had 4. Because when the Russians went through the English Channel, they thought they saw Japanese destroyers, and they opened fire. And what they fired upon were British trawlers, the fishing fleet. And unfortunately, they killed several sailors, and the British were just incensed. And in fact, the British blockaded them in Spain, the Russian fleet in Spain. Eventually, that fleet takes off, and they sail 18,000 miles. There were mutinies. There were breakdowns, total ineptness. And they went across the Indian Ocean without seeing another ship. They could not refuel. And by the way, fuel at that time was coal. And the Russians had no coaling station. So only the admiral, Rozhestvensky, knew where they would be resupplied with coal, which was just absolutely horrible. Anyway, the Russian fleet eventually gets to a place called Tsushima. Tsushima is an island. It means donkey ears in Japanese. And it lays between Korea, South Korea, and Kyushu, the southern island of Japan. And the Japanese had laid a trap. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Japanese had defeated China in 1904 and wanted Manchuria and wanted Port Arthur. But the European powers said, no, you can't have that. But what you can have is the indemnity that China owes you for the war they lost against Japan. And the Japanese took all that money and they invested it in battleships made in British yards. So they had extremely modern battleships bigger than anything in the world, and they knew exactly where the Russians were and when they were coming, and they laid a trap. And as the Russian ships came into view through the as the fog dissipated, the Japanese carried out what Admiral Nelson of the British Navy in the Napoleonic Wars called crossing the T. And this meant that the Japanese ships sailed directly in front of the Russian fleet, firing all 500 of its guns, and they blew apart the Russian fleet, ship after ship after ship, and only 3 survived, or some were sent, were beached, a few others were captured, and only 3 ships actually made it to Vladivostok, and the Russian Admiral Rozhestvensky was captured by the Japanese. He was treated very well, but the Russians lost 10,000 sailors. And, of course, the Tsar thought it was just fate. He took no responsibility whatsoever. There's a term called suba in Russian fate, and he basically wrote it off as God's will. And that was, and following that were the pogroms, which had an enormous effect. In fact, the only country that really benefited from the war at all was not Japan, which won the war, and it was certainly not Russia. It was the United States, because those pogroms influenced hundreds of thousands of people in Poland, in the Ukraine, in Russia, to come to America. And it was that influx of immigration, you know, that gave us the Oppenheimers and all the other great people who came to America. And that was one of the major results. Of course, President Roosevelt received the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the end of that war. But that was the first major conflict of the 20th century.
Wow, that was super, super intriguing and interesting. And your book, Cherry Blossom in Winter, it also has, I just want people to know that it has dangerous family secrets and friendships with revolutionaries in perilous career. One of the key persons in the book, characters, and his life. And so years later, Alexei finds himself aboard ship as the rusting and badly out-of-date Russian fleet is sent away around the world, as you were stating. But I wanted to point out that it does say, will Alexei live to see his love again or die under the blazing guns of the fast-moving enemy cruisers? So you have a lot of interesting reasons for people to want to continue to read this book plus your sequel. And I wanted to point that out.
Well, thank you. What I really found interesting to a degree was what was taking place in the Romanov dynasty. You know, and while Japan was industrializing and their signs said build big guns and industrialize and that type of thing, one of the main characters, or the main character actually, in the Romanov dynasty was Nicholas II. And he had a very, very interesting background. He came to power, of course, in May of 1896, and he was a rather small man, and he lived in a bubble, you know, in this magnificent capital of St. Petersburg. He was called the Little Father by the Russian people, but he knew nothing about their lives, really. The official court language was French, and the signs above all the offices were in German. And Russia was a country at the time. It was marked by, you know, paranoia, anti-Semitism, suspicion, fatalism, superstition, and extreme wealth for the nobility. And if one goes to St. Petersburg today, and I was there and I had an opportunity to visit it, they still see the great palaces on the Nevsky Prospect and along the Neva River in St. Petersburg, including the Hermitage, which of course is now a wonderful museum, and the Yusupov Palace. It was the home of the wealthiest man in Russia. And basically, the purpose of the population was to support the elite. So you had 129 million people supporting 600 families. And these 600 families, their entire lives were made up of continuous mask balls, military and religious ceremonies. And virtually every man wore a uniform. Russia had an army of 4.5 million, but it was called, the steamroll of Europe. But it was obsolete. And the Tsar marries Alexis of Hesse, and she was called the German woman. And one of the interesting things about the Tsar was that he was raised basically by his mother, and she was very, very dominant. She would hire tutors for him, but they would only last 2 days, and then she would fire them. Russia was basically a police state, and it was a fascinating time, of a lot of intrigue, a period of time.
Absolutely. But did your, you know, as a history teacher, did you, when you lived in Japan, did any of that time that you spent in Japan influence your conclusions about Japan and versus Russia? And then in your next sequel, will that include the attack on America by the Japanese?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Japan, yeah, Japan is a fascinating culture, very different from China, and we visited China about 10 months ago, fortunately that far back, so we were not, my wife and I were not affected by the current virus. Yeah, actually, I was stationed on Hokkaido, the northernmost island of Japan, and I was with what was called then the Army Security Agency, which is now under the DIA, and I had an opportunity to investigate and look at the culture of Japan, a very beautiful culture. I wish I knew more about it at the time. I learned much more about it later on. But yes, it was of course, a very different country at the turn of the century. Tokyo was very different. And as you might read in the book about how Japan was going through this transformation. People's clothing was even changing from the traditional clothing to the modern, to the Western clothing. And at that time, of course, late 19th, early 20th century, Japan was a very popular place with the United States. In fact, General Grant went there before he died in 1885, and after he was president, and was given a royal reception. However, the Tsar, or the future Tsar, Nicholas II, went to Russia before he became Tsar and was nearly assassinated. And that really engendered within him a great hatred of the Japanese. But the Russians knew very little about Japan. There was really no contact between them because the railroad was not built until 1897. And then, of course, when I was in Russia, it was fascinating to see what the city might have been like back during that time. It was really quite an astoundingly beautiful city in the summertime. In the wintertime, it's horrifically cold. But yeah, it gave me some very good ideas about what the cultures were like, and that's sometimes what travel affords, an opportunity to see other cultures and compare them and see what motivates the people.
Yeah, that's what fascinated me. I went to Europe for the first time in 2018, and I just felt like I went back in time, and I just tried to imagine what it was like, you know, back in, you know, the days. And I mean, it's amazing, the architecture and the art and the, I mean, it's just unbelievable what they actually created and developed.
Mm-hmm.
And still stands today without the advanced tools that we have today to put buildings up and do artwork and all this. And they did it.
Oh, yeah.
They did it.
Absolutely fascinating.
It is
so
fascinating.
I would like to just mention, if I may, I'd just like to mention a book that I'm sending to Michael James, my friend and my publisher of Penmore Books. And I'm sending this new manuscript to him probably next week. And it's called The Refused, and in French, Le Refusé. And it concerns an American Civil War officer, a survivor of Gettysburg. And by the way, I reenacted at Gettysburg. So I had some pretty good ideas of what it might have been like back in 1863. But this young American Union officer wants desperately to become an artist. And so after he survives Gettysburg, he goes to France, to Paris in 1869. And, of course, his work is refused by the Salon d'Arts. And he falls in with the Impressionist artists, you know, Monet, Degas, Pizarro, Sisley, and so forth. And, of course, falls in love with a Southern woman, and they have a very tumultuous relationship. She'd be coming from the Commonwealth of Virginia. But anyway, his entire world and his... the beginning of his success with the Impressionists, and they were all dirt poor, of course. Nobody regarded their work as real art at that time. but his entire world is upended by the Franco-Prussian War that takes place in 1870 and 1871. And that particular conflict would, of course, 44 years later, lead to World War One. But it was absolutely fascinating to dive back into the early or the late 19th century and investigate what Paris was like at that time during the Second Empire, the time period of Louis Napoleon, a relative Napoleon Bonaparte. And I'm hoping to write a script based on The Refused, all these Impressionist artists whose work was refused by the Salon d'Arts. And, of course, if you could not get into the Salon, you couldn't sell your work. So all these fellows like Degas and Pizarro and Sicily and Monet and Manet all just lived on a shoestring during that particular time and would not become famous for
it. A lot of them still do.
Yeah. And being an artist, I work in stone, I work in paint. I used to work bronze and glass and ceramic and all. I know exactly what that could be like. But I did teach art, so that was kind of fun too.
But love and passion has a lot to do with it. And
yeah,
that's kind of a big reward. So
yeah,
anyway, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to wind up the interview, but I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to your vast knowledge of the history of Russia and Japan and all your wonderful information that you shared with us today. I really appreciate it, Ron Singerton, and I hope everyone goes out and gets a copy of A Cherry Blossom in Winter. And now is your time to shine. You have 1 minute to tell us anything about your books and about your contact information.
It reminds me of the politicians who have a summing up statement. The Villa of Deceit and The Silk and the Sword about Ancient Rome are on Amazon and Amazon UK. A Cherry Blossom in Winter and a sequel, A Blossom in the Ashes, will be out in April. And I just enjoy writing. It's a narcotic, a great narcotic. And I'm blessed to have the support of my wife, Darla, who reads the manuscripts and tells me exactly what is absolutely and wrong with it and how it can be improved, which I appreciate.
That's what wives
and of course
are for.
I have very good editors, and it's very, very important to have a good editor, because even after the fourth writing of a novel, you still make mistakes, and an editor is absolutely essential, as is a very good publisher, Michael James of Penmore Press. So I am absolutely elated to be sending this new manuscript to him. And if people want a really good read, I hope it's a good read, they may go to ronsingerton.com or to Amazon or even Penmore Press and find the novels. And I wish them all the best, and I wish you all the best. And I thank you so very, very much for having given me an opportunity to discuss these books.
Well, thank you, Ron Singerton. Keep up the good work, and we'll look forward to hearing about The Refuse and all your future books as well and your script. So you have a great day, and God bless. Pardon?
Thank you. And if there's a director or producer out there who wants to make a great movie, have them get in touch. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Ron Singerton has left the building, and on that note, we will leave the world of authors and experts, and we will enter into the last few minutes on information about what's on everybody's mind, the coronavirus. Italy's rate of coronavirus infections is slowing since implementing drastic quarantine measures, even as the death toll rises to 345, from 345 to 2,503, and medics warn of catastrophic situation number of daily coronavirus cases in Italy has been fairly stagnant in recent days at around 3,500 per day. Yesterday's 12.6% rise in overall tally of infections was the second lowest since virus started spreading in Italy. But I also want to remind you that the recovery rate is, according to what I've read online by doctors and experts, is at 77%. Some people say even as high as 90% in different countries. So it is pretty much like the flus we've experienced in the past as far as the recovery rate goes. And so that's a very important point to remember, that people do recover as well. There is a drug being used to treat flu in Japan. It is clearly effective in treating coronavirus, Chinese officials are claiming. You can read that on Daily Mail. And worldwide coronavirus infection toll hits 200,000 after doubling in less than 2 weeks, but that doesn't mean that 200,000 people died. So that is people who had symptoms, they had to be isolated. And about, let's see if it gives you here. No, that's just the rate of people who are infected. But that doesn't mean everyone is dying. So let's be sure that we get that straight, because many, many people will catch the flu when you don't take precautions, and that is the responsibility of everyone to take precautions. Total cases in the USA, 7,038. Total deaths, 97. So that is no different, actually, when you think about and you Google and research how many people die from the flu in the USA every year. It's about less than two people, percentage-wise, die every day from the flu. So, let's see if we got any other information here. Data included both confirmed and presumptive cases of the coronavirus reported to CDC or tested at CDC since January 2020. So that's 7,038 cases in the USA since January 2020 and 97 deaths. And we have 330 million plus people in the United States. So 109 people die on average every day. And it appears that it's kind of a scare, because the CDC predicts that at least 12,000 Americans will die from the flu in any given year. As many as 61,000 people died between the years of 2017 and 18 during the flu season, and 45 million were infected. And that was reported on February 7th, 2020. So there were at least 12,000 Americans who died from the flu in any given year. As many as 61,000 people died between 2017 and 2018 out of 330 million people. And 45 million were infected but didn't die. So it appears that the coronavirus really isn't any different than any other flu, in my opinion, other than it came as a surprise, and it seems as if it hit Europe, which is closer to China than we are, and they do not have the same health hygiene products and treatments and modern-day treatments that we have in the USA, and education on health and hygiene. And so Some countries don't even use soap. They only use water. Some people have contaminated water. Some people have more elderly people over 80. People over 80, many of them have health issues, underlying health issues. They may already have respiratory problems from smoking during their lifetime or other issues, or taking prescription drugs that can affect your organs and damage your kidneys or your lungs or whatever. There are many, many reasons why people die, and the average age for death is 75. So if you're over 80, you pass the average that statistic when people die. So it's not that we shouldn't take care of the elderly. They could be your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. Of course we should. But how can you compare people who are over 80 to people who are under 50, let's say? So everybody's an individual. We shouldn't throw everybody into the same pot and boil everybody alive. And bankrupt our nation or the world because of the flu. And we know they're going to come out with a vaccine or a prescription that's going to cure the coronavirus. And I believe you can take that to the bank. So stay alert, stay vigil, stay proactive, use the disinfectants, wash your hands, use soap and water, and take precautions not to go into large crowds. And hopefully everything will turn back to normal and people will be back to work, businesses will open, and because this is affecting so many small businesses as well as big companies, but especially small businesses who probably will not be opening their doors again, and all the people who live paycheck to paycheck. God bless you. God bless America. And remember, prayer is powerful. Prayer is very powerful. Pray and ask for God's intervention and to smite the coronavirus, and to keep the people around the world healthy, and that's all we can do. Talk to you again next week. This is the Rose signing off, and be safe.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.